Part 102. The streetcars were running, but on a Sunday schedule, so we got a little cold waiting for one. We got to the Ronan's apartment above his small tailor's shop around 2:30 and shed our coats and boots. Maud now had a pair of boots, but had brought some slippers she'd knitted, as had Pole. We were introduced to Hannah, Nate's wife, and gave her our contribution to the day, some cheese straws Maud had made. The first since 1939. And some rock cakes. Maud said apologetically, "I'm afraid I'll have to ask for the tins back. They belong to Mart, the woman whose house we live in." "That's okay. Changing country, you can't bring everything," Hannah observed. We were ushered into a cozy living room. I said this time last year, I only had my uniform and a few personal items. My civilian clothing went up with the V1. It turned out that Nate hadn't shared our story with Hannah and it got related. "So you're almost newlyweds. My goodness. Well, we'll wish you well, and Pole as well, of course." Nate said, "Is what you're wearing one of the British demob suits?" "Yes, I got this last February 7th. The day I met Maud." Nate came over and felt the cloth and looked at the lining of the jacket. "Good material and well made, but the style is almost Chicago gangster." "Yes, I'm afraid so. The only other suit I have is one of Jeremy's. Maud's late husband. It doesn't fit me perfectly, but I can get away with wearing it if nobody looks too closely. Come and see me with it and it can probably be adjusted," Nate said. I realized that was true. Through the afternoon we chatted. Nate and Hannah brought out some photo albums and found a few old photos that might overlap with Pole's side of the family. At one point, Pole commented that a man looked very much like her father, but he was of at least one generation earlier. I made some notes of names and dates, but it was all a bit uncertain. We ate dinner around 5, a very nice roast chicken. Hannah asked, "How are you finding things, Maud? Will you be happy as a housewife here?" "With Mart around and sharing the household duties, I've time on my hands. I've thought of looking for a job or doing some volunteer work." Hannah said, "Nathan, I think you should see if Maud might be able to help you out. We had a young man as a shop assistant. If Nate is working on a garment, it is an interruption when people come in the shop. But he joined the army, and we heard that he's going to move to Toronto now he's back, as he has a girl there he wants to marry." Nate said that it might work. "Did you adjust Pole's skirt?" "Yes." "How did you know?" "It's done well, but the thread is a shade off in color." "Yes. I had trouble finding the one I did use. Things in England were, still are, in short supply. Here too, but getting better quickly. And there will be men home from serving who will want new suits. I'm thinking of opening Saturday, but I might not show my face then to avoid talk from the rabbis." It was decided Maud would try a few hours each week on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. The pay was not much, and I was not sure if Nate hadn't offered as a form of charity. We'd see. Part 103. Also on the 18th, 50 phoned us and said he'd been offered 6 tickets for the Canadiens Maple Leafs hockey game on Boxing Day. Would we like to go with him, Denise and one of her brothers? I agreed, providing he let me pay him for the tickets. He said okay and that they cost around $2 each. Up in the gods, but he said it was a real Canadian thing you had to experience. He gave us the tickets at our little party on the 21st, and since they would drive in from Lachute before the game, Maud, Pole and I would meet them in the seats. Maud found out about buses at the library. The schedule was reduced, but the librarian said that after the game there were usually extra buses and streetcars, but to have warm clothes in case there were a wait. 50 was right that it was an experience. We were amazed how fast the game was. It made football look very pedestrian and rough. Just 1 minute into the game and Toronto player Gus Mortson got 2 minutes in the penalty box for something called roughing. Montreal then had an extra player, though both teams had 16 players dressed, with 6 on the ice at once. All but the goaltender kept changing. That probably helped keep them moving so fast. Montreal didn't score during the advantage. It seemed that you couldn't shoot the puck all the way to the other end of the ice normally. If you did, the referee or linesman. I couldn't quite figure out who was who. Would blow the whistle and there would be a face-off in your own end. But when you had a man in the penalty box, you could get rid of the puck, which would let you change tired players. Soon after, both teams had 6 players on the ice. Only 3.5 minutes into the game, Montreal's captain Toe Blake. An odd name that, apparently a nickname. Scored. The noise in the forum was deafening. Maud noticed. She had to shout in my ear that the men were mostly in suits and the women dressed up. At the break, we made a mistake and said halftime, but there were 3 20-minute periods. 50 said it was a Montreal tradition to dress up for the Habs games. Habs was another nickname. Like Gunners for the Arsenal football team, I supposed. Though we didn't need it, I went with 50 and we got hot dogs during the intermission. They would have substantially exceeded the meat allowance limit in England. Canada definitely had some advantages for us. We learned from chatter that Mortson, the player who got the first penalty, then another at the 12-minute mark that also got him ejected from the game with a misconduct, was the most penalised player in the league. But apart from the misconduct, there were 3 penalties to each side in the first period alone. Montreal won the game 4-1. I found I enjoyed watching. Later on, Maud admitted she liked it too, and listening to her, I realized she had a better eye than I for how patterns on the ice were developing that could lead to goals or to good chances. Paul thought it was interesting, but I don't think it took her imagination, though she said she would like to learn how to skate. That seemed like something we could arrange. Part 104. As we rode home on the streetcar, Paul said the ring 50 gave Denise was really pretty. Yes, it was nice. It must have been expensive, Maud added. I felt awkward that I had not noticed. 50 had told me that he and Denise were anxious to get married. He was waiting for the divorce proceedings to be completed. There were, it seemed, a lot of marriages that had broken down with men away fighting. Well, with men away. In Canada, the conscription rules supposedly required consent to be sent overseas. Apparently only 12,000 conscripts fought overseas. Then also there was the HMCS Uganda vote. If I had the story straight, after VE Day, the Canadian government said servicemen had to re-volunteer for the Pacific campaign and would get 30 days leave before they were sent. But Uganda was already in action. Still, the ship took a vote and 2/3 of the crew said they wanted out. Some comments suggest it was because the ship wasn't set up for tropical service and things were pretty miserable on board. Anyway, they stayed for 2 months, then were on their way back to Canada when a boiler broke down. In Pearl Harbor, there was resentment that they were quitters, as the war hadn't ended, though this was about the time of the A-bombs. Canada had some awkward differences between the different factions. We'd have to tiptoe through a new sort of minefield to avoid trouble for ourselves. No doubt 50 and Denise had similar delicate matters to worry about. Divorce wasn't contemplated in French-Canadian families. Nor was living together. And an Anglo and a Franco under one roof. I was beginning to learn the subtexts of conversations. Part 104A. Saturday, December 28, 1946. Maud decided she wanted to lie in, but for some reason the rest of the household was up by 8 o'clock, and having some toast and coffee in lieu of breakfast. Outside it was cold and there was a bit of snow falling. Paul said, "Can we go and see if the river is frozen over?" For some reason, we decided just to do that, but Mart and Lise wanted to clear up some of the leftover turkey they'd brought back from Lichute. They also wanted to clear out other odds and ends to make space in the refrigerator. Paul and I dressed warmly and were out the door by 8:30. Another walk to water, like we'd done to Southampton Water last spring. "Look! It's mostly frozen over," Paul exclaimed. "But I gather it's very dangerous to walk on, even when parts are thick ice, other parts are weak," I responded, not recalling who had told me that. "Yes. We got a warning at school the other week. There are stories about people skating on the river, but now I think most skating is on prepared rinks like the one we walked by in the park." "You said you'd like to try skating," I commented. "Yes. Liz and I have started to look for skates for me."
"Have you got enough money?"
"Of course I do. You know I took $15 out of the bank the other week and not spent $5 yet."
"Good for you, Paul."
Maybe we should say good for us, Paul sounded pensive.
"Yes. I think we've done well. I hope you don't feel too, oh, I'm not sure how to say this, perhaps mixed up is the expression. What I mean is, all the changes in your life, our lives, in the last year could be pretty overwhelming."
"I suppose so." Paul said this softly, then we were quiet for a few minutes, just watching the river, which still had some open channels where moving water could be seen. Then Paul said, "I actually think I'm more settled now than a year ago. Then I was worried about Tant Mathilde. You know, was she getting, in England they sometimes say dotty, the which sort of hides the sadness of getting, is the word the senile?"
"Yes, that must have been worrying for you."
"It was. Especially as I'd heard nothing about my parents, but as I told you, I'd dreamt that they were dead, and somehow I'd accepted that. But I didn't know what would happen to me, and that had me very scared. I think both Maud and I realized that."
"Ted, was that why you and Maud got married?"
"For me?"
"Like we said when we suggested we become a family, it pushed the timing forward. I think Maud and I would eventually have got together. Your situation, or really lack of a situation, just pushed the timing forward. And, you know, it's really been a good thing. I found I really love Maud and get along with her."
"Did you not get along with Agnes?"
"Yes. We had a good relationship. A good marriage. But each person is different, and I suspect each marriage. Each family. I don't remember my French family much. That bothers me. I think I told you before, and you said how hard it was to remember voices and faces in detail. But with you and Maud I feel. I belong. And that despite all the changes. With my French parents I felt secure and loved. I missed that when Tant Mathilde took me to England, even though she was very kind and caring. Somehow a mother and father who love you is special, and you and Maud have given me something of that, but since I'm older it feels different. Perhaps because all of us have more history and experience. We're probably also afraid of the pain of losing someone we love. I know when you came into our lives I had a few moments where I wondered what would happen if we formed our family and then for some reason you were taken from us. I didn't tell either of you, but I had a couple of bad dreams where Mrs. Carberry came to say I had to go to the hostel because you and Maud were unsuitable.
That must have been upsetting."
"A bit. Somehow I think all the preparations for coming here took all our time and pushed aside the time to think and fret about anything like that.
Do you like it here? I asked. Oh yes. I still feel a little lost, but you have to remember that in Southampton Tante Mathilde and I were more or less camping in that awful room. After I was taken away from France until we formed our family together, I didn't really have a home. Now I feel okay. Not perfect, of course, but I think I'll be fine. What about school? I've seen how hard you work. School's fine. I've made a couple of friends. And I get along well with Lise, so I've connections outside of school with people in her circle. I hope there's not any bullying at school. Kids can be nasty sometimes. I think there was one girl who tried to be nasty, but I told her bluntly that I'd survived the Nazis coming into Paris, the fact they'd killed my parents and their bombing of Southampton. I told her that if she insisted that I was her enemy, I couldn't do anything about it, but I wouldn't let her push me around. She said she guessed I was okay. We're not friends, but we say hello and she doesn't bother me. Good for you, Paul. I was actually pretty scared. It was all bravado, but it worked. Part 105. We spent a quiet New Year's Eve and went to bed right after a midnight toast to 1947 in a tiny drop of our brandy. We even let Paul have a taste. In bed in my arms, Maud said, "I wonder if 1947 will have as many changes for us as 1946. Hope not, I answered. While I think most of the changes for us were good ones, it makes me tired thinking about them. Me too. But I'm really, really, really happy you married me. Ah. Admitting to being a sex maniac, are you? If I did, would you mind? Probably not. Though I sincerely doubt you are. We like that side of things, but I don't think it's the key to what makes us tick together. True. You know, Jeremy and I never talked about us. That is, our feelings about each other. I think it was that day we went to Winchester when we caught each other looking at our reflection together that was the moment that everything changed for me. For me it was definitely a pivotal moment, too. You know, Paul and I walked to look at the St. Lawrence on Saturday and she asked if we'd got married just for her. I told her no, but that her situation or lack thereof had pushed us forward. Talking to her made me realize I'm very, very happy we did find each other. Paul also asked if I got along with Agnes, and I told her that I did, but that each person and marriage and family are unique. Certainly our current family is. I heard a French-Canadian the other day say it for sure, but it sounded really emphatic, with a long, long sure. For sure. Well, I think that describes how I'd answer the question, are you happy with Maud? Me too. Well, with you. Oh. It's too late to sort out the grammar. We kissed. Gently and unhurriedly. Night, Ted. Sleep tight, Maud. Part 106. On the evening of Sunday, January 12th, Gerard Lapointe called at about 8 p.m. Ted. We've got a problem at McCall Field in Calgary. We were down to one mechanic because the junior man decided to go with a new startup. They've made him a partner. Flying charters into northern Alberta and BC. And Pritchard, the man who was left, has had appendicitis. He'd started advertising and was going to interview tomorrow, which can't go ahead now. We've got someone from the office in Calgary. The booking staff actually. Postponing the interviews until Tuesday. The candidates who are coming in from elsewhere are going to be upset and we'll have to compensate them if we don't want to stink. We've also approved a clerk warehouseman to handle the parts inventory, but hadn't even advertised yet. So I'm going to send you out to do the interviews and try to engage someone. Make it probationary for 3 months. For the clerical position. I assume this means tomorrow morning's flight 301, I said. Afraid so. I'll make sure there's money available to you there. Just sign for it and make sure there's a good paper trail. But that's sort of what you do, so perhaps it goes without saying. Never hurts to give people a reminder. All right. I'll leave a file at the check-in desk for you. Plan to be away for up to a week, though hopefully it won't take that long. Your outward flight's okay. May have to mess around a bit on the way back depending on how full the planes are. I'll send you summary information via teleprinter as it becomes available. Oh. Thanks, Ted. I'd not thought of that, but it would be good to be kept up to date. Good night. Needless to say, we rushed around to pack my suitcase and try to remember what I would need. I emptied my fountain pen. Pressure changes could cause leaks. And I made sure I had sharpened pencils in a small briefcase I'd bought myself recently. It served well to carry my lunch. Then I tried to think of anything I might need and made sure I had addresses and telephone numbers, but copied them to my notebook so Maud would have them here in Montreal. Part 107. I got up at 6 a.m., which was about half an hour earlier than usual, and had some toast. I was fairly certain I get fed on the flights, and besides, being TCA staff would get me some perks. It was up and down a lot for a long, long day. Ottawa took about an hour. About two and a bit more to Toronto Moulton. Then hop, skip and jump to Winnipeg via St. Marie and the twin cities of Port Arthur and Fort William. Then another couple of hours to reach Ina and finally into Calgary at 10:15. I was going to travel with the flight crew to the Palliser Hotel where the file from Gerard showed I had a reservation. I went with the pilots to the office, introduced myself. I had business cards now and apparently my name was known to the man on duty. And asked if I could use the telephone. The man pointed to a vacant desk and said to push any button not lit up to get a line. Hello, said a voice that was not very familiar, though it must have been Joseph. Hello, Ted Newman here. Ted, are you calling long distance? No. I've just got off a very long set of flights from Montreal. A minor emergency here in Calgary I've been sent to try to sort out. But I wanted to let you know I'm here and will be at the Palliser Hotel for a few days. Not sure at this moment about anything else at all. But we'll be able to meet up anyway? Certainly. I just don't have specific times just yet. Still, we've made contact and we'll catch up, come hell or high water. Oh. The crew is about to leave. I've got to go or I'll miss my transport. I'll try to call tomorrow and leave a message with Caroline if possible. Or else call tomorrow evening much earlier. Okay, Ted. Talk to you soon. Part 108. The Palliser was, from the outside, very nice. My single room was adequate, but didn't quite match the facade. It had hot and cold water, but baths and toilets were down the hall. Still, I slept well. I'd forgotten to bring an alarm clock, but could order a wake-up from the staff. I asked for 7 a.m., but because of the time zone difference of 2 hours, I was awake at 6:30 and about to go down to breakfast when the knock came. I'd had the good sense to ask the van driver the night before when there would be a similar shuttle for crew in the morning, and was ready and waiting for it. When I got to McCall Field sometime before 9, I found the office of the Calgary Operations Manager, a Mr. Charles McAvoy. He seemed to be a little younger than I, and had a limp. Good, you are here to try to get parts and maintenance up and running, Newman. We've got a mechanic, but he's pretty new, and nobody else to make sure everything's checked and tickety-boo. I gather the interviews have been set back to today, I said.
Yes. We've set you up in Pritchard's office. Hope that's okay.
Yes, fine. But is there a receptionist?
Up here, just my secretary, Miss Jensen, who runs errands all over the place.
So we've told the candidates.
There's just three.
To report to the commissionaire in the hangar lobby and he'll let you know they are here in the waiting room.
I suggest you give a time for him to send them up.
That'll give you time to get a smoke or take a pee between interviews. However, I took the liberty of asking them to arrive at 10:15, 11, and 1 as I wasn't sure how, fresh you'd be this morning. The Montreal flight isn't a piece of cake, no matter how we claim it is in our advertisements. Almost like being on a pogo stick.
You have me at a disadvantage. I don't know what a pogo stick is.
Kid's toy. Sort of a broomstick with a spring in the bottom to jump up and down. You'll likely see them around in the spring. By the way, is that an RAF badge?
We took a couple of minutes to exchange service background.
McAvoy had been a flight instructor, having flown in the 30s for a two-plane charter outfit then qualified on Hurricanes. He didn't get overseas before a student he was training managed to prang the Harvard trainer into the runway so hard the undercarriage collapsed. That was, I understood, pretty difficult to do on the Harvard, which was notoriously robust. In this case, McAvoy lost a leg. The student pilot didn't make it.
Is there a labor exchange or employment office around?
I asked.
Federal government has one in the public building not far from the Palliser.
You thinking of using it to get a mechanic?
No.
We're approved for a Clark warehouseman to handle the parts and their tracking.
I don't have time to advertise.
We need to track parts and make sure you can keep going. So I plan to hire someone on probation.
I'll definitely appreciate knowing anything plus or minus about how they're doing later on, if you're willing.
If I'm not willing, I'm shooting myself in the foot.
My good foot.
McAvoy laughed.
We'd get along.
As soon as I left McAvoy's office, his secretary showed me Pritchard's office. She was also helpful in bringing me some ink to fill my pen and thoughtful enough to bring a notepad and ask me how I liked my coffee. I made sure I knew the phone number of the office and the extension in the office I was sitting in, and asked if I could have the number of the labor office at the public building. Whoever answered there didn't seem surprised that I telephoned and dictated my requirement. I suggested that prospective candidates could present themselves to the commissionaire at McCall Field Municipal Hangar tomorrow at 9 a.m. with any documents they had to support their potential hiring, and I would interview them. I knew I was probably not following TCA policy and procedure, but felt I could take that risk given what LaPointe had said.
Part 109.
Of today's three candidates, two were in their Sunday best in the American parlance. However, they were essentially garage mechanics who'd been drafted in on a few occasions to help get something like a Fairchild 82 started so it could get out of a remote lake. They wouldn't be that useful on DC-3s or Lodestars, which both use twin WASP engines. And they wouldn't realize the importance of keeping track of what had been done. The other candidate was rather rough-looking, in a lumberjack plaid shirt. There was the evidence of oil in the corners of his fingernails. He was, it turned out, the last candidate, and the only one likely to be of use to us.
Tell me about yourself, I said.
My name is Richard Boyer. I was born in Saskatchewan in 1920. My parents are Métis in origin, but my father fought in the Great War and somehow that let him get a job running a grain elevator. So I got to go to school, and I liked learning. And the local garage let me learn about motors. When the war came, I joined the RCAF as a fitter, and got to learn about other engines.
Went to Europe.
all over the place. And now back here. I'm working back in a garage in Red Deer. Only been back 6 months. It's more difficult to get a good job if you're Métis.
Where were you in Europe?
I've got it all written down in my service record, but I can tell you the names of the places off the top of my head. Debden, Redhill, Exeter, St. Croix-sur-Mer, Douai, Melsbroek, Breda, Eindhoven, Twente, Lüneburg.
So you've experience on lots of engines?
Yes. Wasps, double wasps, Merlins, Napier Sabres. Very touchy they are. Even a Griffon at the end. Got to look at one of the new jets one day on a Meteor, but not to work on it.
Where were you on New Year's Day, 2 years ago?
I asked, as a check on his veracity.
Jumping into a slit trench big enough for three men.
Except there were six of us. Jerry gave us a pasting. 141 planes wrecked on the ground. That was Eindhoven.
I know. I wasn't far away. I did parts and logistics for the RAF. They seconded me from Supermarine in Southampton. In fact, I was back working there until the end of October.
Boyer smiled. Then you know what it was like.
Yes. I was in Antwerp during the V-bombing and saw my share. And my wife and daughter were killed by a V-1 while I was in Normandy.
Mon Dieu. Then you've had it all.
But somehow doing all right now. I met a widow. I'll leave out her story. And we've adopted a French orphan whose parents were killed in the camps. Our daughter is a joy and bringing us back to normal.
It's none of my business, really, but are you married?
Yes. Very recently. It's hard not to be able to give Jocelyn more. The garage pay isn't great.
Look.
This isn't how it's supposed to be done. But we need someone here rather urgently. I'm prepared to offer you a mechanic's job here starting as soon as you can, on probation for 3 months, of course, but permanent assuming things work out. This involves also keeping track of the parts so we can maintain inventory. We're also trying to hire a clerk warehouseman to ease that burden.
Boyer asked, what would the salary be?
I'm embarrassed to say I'll have to look in this file.
Oh. Here it is.
I showed him the sheet detailing the job.
As I'm a logistics person, I don't know all the rules on hiring, so I'm going to have to ask someone.
Let me call the secretary to the operations manager.
I buzzed that efficient lady and was told who was in charge of the formalities and phoned that office and to inform them Richard Boyer would be presenting himself to complete hiring procedures tomorrow at 9 a.m. for the probationary position of aircraft mechanic.
I've one more thing to say, Richard. Here are two $10 bills. I want you to come tomorrow in slacks, shirt and tie, or even a suit. You can pay me back when you can. But I don't want anybody to not give you proper respect because of how you're dressed. I'd have sent you today to do the paperwork, but think it would be better that you come in tomorrow looking top drawer.
I have seen that our mechanics in Montreal have monogrammed overalls that TCA supplies, so I'll assume the same here. So ask about them if nobody offers, as I'm sure there'll be some around for the ground crew here.
Wow. Thank you, Mr. Newman. I'll go shopping right away this afternoon. And I'll have to see how long I can stay at the YMCA, or if I can find a place for Jocelyn and I. We're living with her parents for now. You can be sure I'll pay you back. It's really generous of you.
Consider it Air Force solidarity.
Part 110. It was getting towards 2 o'clock. 4 p.m. for me, and that was how I felt.
I'd had a quick sandwich from the coffee counter in the waiting room between the last two candidates. What should I do now? First, I wrote down notes on the interviews and a statement that I was recommending the hiring of Richard Boyer. Pritchard. Better find out how he was doing. I went to the washroom. That was the expression here. And then went to find Miss Jensen. I finished the interviews and I think we've got a live one in Richard Boyer. I'm having him start tomorrow morning. So now I should inform Pritchard and find out how he's doing. Can you tell me how we would do that? I heard he's in the Holy Cross Hospital. You could telephone and see if he's allowed visitors. That's what I did and learnt that it would likely be better to visit on the next day, as Pritchard was recovering from surgery and they wanted to be sure he was willing to have a visitor. Visiting hours were 3 to 4 or 7 to 8. So now I was more or less free from immediate tasks for today. I phoned Joseph's number and got Caroline. She was excited and wanted to meet me and suggested I come as soon as I could. I said that it would definitely not be before 4 as I needed to complete some things first. In fact, the first thing I did was go to the communications room. A Mr. Bevan who was monitoring the radio frequencies of our aircraft helped me by sending a teleprinter message to Gerard Lapointe saying I tentatively hired a mechanic and planned to interview clerks in the morning. Then I returned to Pritchard's office and checked and updated my notes on the day's activities. I also made sure my expenses so far, rather few as yet, were recorded in my notebook. Finally, I phoned Miss Jensen and asked whether the hotel would want me to pay, no was the answer, and if I could get an advance on expenses. I've actually got $40 here for you. I should have given it to you earlier. I said I'd pick it up on my way out. Then I put on my coat and hat, flaps up. I'd not be waiting outside in the cold, picked up the cash, then went down and found a taxi to the Palliser. There I took a shower and changed, then asked the bellhop where I could A, buy a bottle of wine or sherry and B, get to 312 9 Street Northwest. The bellhop told me where I could find the nearest Alberta liquor store. He warned me I'd need proof of age. And from there where the streetcar that went over the Louise Bridge was to be found. I was glad I'd brought my passport, since I didn't yet have a driver's license or other identification, though I did have my TCA card with my photograph, which was needed to get into some of the sensitive parts of Dorval Airport. But that didn't give my age. Part 111. The Alberta Liquor Store was clearly designed to make alcoholic drinks as unattractive as possible. I bought a bottle of Harvey's Sherry. It was practically the only thing I recognized, and I was never much for spirits, except in very small quantities. I took a streetcar to the north side of the Louise Bridge and got off. There were electric trolleybuses crossing the bridge as well. Those were what Joseph had mentioned in his letters. There was a bit of a breeze, and I was glad of my moleskin coat. I walked north along 10th Street, passing some shops, including a furrier named Rudolph. Maud would love the full-length mink on display. I turned east at 2nd Avenue Northwest and found the address I'd been writing to. The woman who answered the door still had the face of the Caroline I remembered from more than 2 decades before, but it was now lined and had a frame of grey hair. I was bundled inside and faced a machine gun rate of questions. In a while Caroline calmed down a little and we fell into a comfortable conversation for about 20 minutes, after which Joseph arrived and things got frantic again for a while. I stayed until quite late. There was too much to talk about. Joseph walked me to the streetcar, which he said would get me to the Palliser as fast as he could drive me. He was probably right. The trip took only a few minutes. We agreed that I would telephone when I knew what my plans would be after I had seen what candidates presented themselves in the morning. My hope was that I could find someone for the clerk position in the morning, see Pritchard in the afternoon, and planned to go home to Montreal on Thursday. It was most likely I'd be on the overnight flight that went out at 6:15 in the evening. Part 112. I used the shuttle again in the morning and checked for any messages. Gerard had sent a simple good work on the teleprinter. There were 10 candidates who were downstairs at 9 o'clock. This could be awkward. They made the waiting room look more full than it would usually be. I had given the commissionaire a sheet on which each candidate could write their name and address. I called out each name and when they responded I assigned times, starting with 9:10, then every 5 minutes thereafter. They should present themselves upstairs at their assigned time. I told each they would have 4 minutes to tell me their qualifications and interest in the job, and that I would inform everyone at 10 o'clock who was on the short list. Some of the candidates seemed annoyed by this, but I needed to bring the group down to a workable size. Of the 10, only 3 had brought any documentation to support their claim of experience or training suitable for the job we had. 2 of those were 1945 high school graduates, and their documentation was their report card for grade 12. Some of the undocumented 7 might have been suitable. 2 claimed to have been part of transport units, and 3 claimed to have been NCOs, but they hadn't brought their service records with them. Ivan Badik had grown up on his Ukrainian immigrant parents' farm not far from the Saskatchewan border. When he graduated high school in 1940, he had volunteered for the Royal Canadian Navy. After some time in coastal protection vessels, he was assigned to a corvette in late 1941. Cold, wet, and very bouncy, Flower-class corvettes fought the sea and bad conditions as much as German submarines. Ivan was ordered to assist the quartermaster in ensuring the ship had sufficient food, fuel, parts, and ammunition to carry out her missions. When new ships were commissioned, he moved and was promoted, ending up as the quartermaster on another of Canada's Flowers. At 10 I went down to the commissionaire's desk and called over the 7 who had no documentation. I asked them to gather round me in a corner of the waiting room and thanked them for coming. However, I pointed out that in my task of finding someone to handle critical parts of our aircraft, I needed to be able to document objects and actions. Some of them might have expertise we could use, but the lack of documents to verify their claims did them no favors. I then asked for the 2 new graduates from high school and thanked them, and also commended them for bringing their documents, but that they did not appear to have sufficient experience for the position. Finally, I asked Ivan to join me upstairs where I discussed what we needed in the new position to ensure he was what he claimed and that I was happy with hiring him. Then I told him that I was prepared to offer him a probationary position. In discussing the job, I had told Ivan the starting salary. Good, but not extravagant. And he had seemed very interested. In any event, he smiled broadly when I told him I was going to make the offer. Part 113. When I looked at the clock, I realized it was just before 11. Ivan was filling out forms with the administrative office. Richard Boyer had been there just before him. I walked over to one of our hangars where I had heard Richard was being introduced to the tasks he would be expected to undertake. The mechanic showing him some job with a twin Wasp engine was the only one we'd had on Monday. I noted that somehow Richard had on overalls. But then, there were other staff working the apron to service the aircraft, fuel, luggage and other things, so overalls were not exclusive to mechanics. I chatted briefly with both men, reminding them that we wanted to make their work easier and would welcome suggestions and comments as we evolved better systems to support the documentation of the parts and maintenance. They seemed pleased I'd set in motion the hiring of Ivan and said they would help him to get going. They were, after all, doing the tasks now he would be taking over so they could focus on maintenance. Air travel was growing. Ivan's help wouldn't give them a long respite. Part 114. I had quite a lot of time until I could see Pritchard at 3 o'clock, so I took a bus to downtown. I went into the Hudson's Bay Company on 1st Street and ate lunch in the restaurant, had a brief look round the store, then went to my hotel room to drop off my notes. At 3:15 I got a taxi to the Holy Cross and found the ward where Pritchard was recovering from his appendectomy.
"Hello. Mr. Alan Pritchard?"
"Who's asking?" came the reply, rather defensively. "Ted Newman, parts and maintenance for TCA out of Montreal."
"They sent you out to keep things running?"
"Yes. A bit of a panic."
"How are you doing?"
"Sore. Hungry. Bored. But those are my problems. Did Jeff keep the planes flying?"
"Jeff was the lone mechanic on Monday and Tuesday."
"Yes. Fortunately, no problems. Just inspection checks. I interviewed the candidates who'd responded to your ads yesterday, and a fellow named Richard Boyer started today."
"Think a French Indian will be reliable?"
"Pritchard was maybe a year or so older than I. His attitude to a man who had fought across Europe for Canada left something to be desired. I said he's been in plenty of tricky situations and managed to keep going. And those can be verified in his service record. He'll be useful when we get the North Stars and their Merlins."
"He's worked on them?"
"Yes.
Have you?"
"No. Reserved occupation. Here the whole war. We pretty much just had the DC-3.
"Reserved occupation can be a tricky situation to be in. Even if you wanted to volunteer, you can't, and other people give you the evil eye because you don't have to."
"Yeah, that's about it."
"Boyer should be an asset. Maybe make your team number one in Canada. I was in a lot of the same places he was, but probably not quite at the same time. And he was RCAF and I was RAF, but often we shared bases. But I was able to ask some questions he wouldn't have been able to answer unless he'd really been there, so I'm confident he's genuine. And unless I'm mistaken, he'll prove a really good mechanic. And today I hired a former Corvette quartermaster for the Clark warehouseman position. He's happy enough with the pay, but he's had more responsibility on a ship than we're likely to give him. If he turns out well, we'll want to see how we can use his skills to make all our lives easier. I didn't mention Ivan's name. I'd heard negative slurs about Bohunks.
Well, it doubles the size of my team, anyway," Pritchard admitted.
Part 115. I phoned Caroline from the hospital lobby and suggested she and Joseph meet me at the Palliser and we have dinner there. My suggestion was 6:30 unless they left a message at the hotel, and I'd wait in the hotel lobby. I put my hat flaps down as I walked to the streetcar stop. It was cold, but not snowing, and not too much on the ground. I realized I hadn't sent LaPointe a report. Have to do it in the morning. For a few minutes I went over my notes, then made a list of things I wanted to do in the morning. If I had time, I'd see what I could do to get the new men up and running. Then I had a bit of a nap. On my way into the hotel, I arranged with the desk that I should be given a wake-up knock at 6:15 if I was not down in the lobby. I actually woke in time. A bit of an old habit from time in the RAF that I could more or less wake up when I wanted to if I thought about it enough before sleeping. We had a very nice dinner. My treat since I was on expenses, and I knew I spent less than my per diem most of the time. We all had beef, as apparently Alberta beef was considered pretty good. In fact, I'd never had such a steak before, and the roast beef Joseph and Caroline had looked excellent. And the portions were large. I'll have to watch my waistline. It was a great comfort to reconnect with my brother. A lot of silly and seemingly inconsequential memories were revived, apparently for both of us. Caroline was a bit wistful about some of the places she remembered. One or two were now gone. I don't think either of them quite understood what the bombs could do, even though there had been plenty of pictures in newspapers and magazines.
Part 116. I checked out of the Palliser in the morning. Indeed, I'd informed them the night before that I'd be leaving. Once again, I shuttled to the airport with a flight crew. The first thing I did after putting my luggage in Pritchard's office was send Lapointe a teleprinter message to update him. Should have done that yesterday. Then I went to the ticket desk and asked if there were space on flight 106 at 6:15 tonight. While they were looking, I had a moment of panic when I realized that I'd misread the schedule. 106 was the only flight that let me get home without an overnight layover somewhere. And 106 was itself an overnight flight. The booking agent came back to say that flight 106 was full. Actually not from Calgary, but Winnipeg to Toronto. Now I was in a pickle. But the agent said I could pick up the Vancouver to Montreal flight in Lethbridge. It left there at 3:05 in the morning. I could take either the 2:30 p.m. or 10:25 p.m. flights to Lethbridge. I wouldn't have to get off the Vancouver to Montreal plane at all. It went all the way to Montreal and kept the same flight number. I didn't find out if it was a DC-3 or a Lockheed Lodestar. Probably the latter, as we seemed to use them on the transcontinental run through Lethbridge. I got myself booked on the 2:30 flight to Lethbridge. And I confirmed they'd a space on the Lethbridge to Montreal. In Lethbridge, I could introduce myself to the maintenance staff there and hopefully find a meal and something to keep me occupied until the early morning. For some reason, TCA started flying their transcontinental routes through Lethbridge rather than Calgary. Perhaps the mountain passes were easier on that route. Maybe I'd go into town and take a look, though winter and a prairie town might be not very interesting. Getting the booking today was a close call. The timetable had jumps and sideways arrows. Even with the 6:15 flight, I'd have had to change from 106 to flight 40 in Toronto in the morning as it was. Some of the flights on the schedule stopped in awkward places. Others flew right over Calgary. Since I had time, I went down to the hangar and found Jeff. I should make sure I know his last name. Richard and Ivan working out what they were going to do today. They had a list of what absolutely had to be done, and suggested that for today, they do it as a trio, with Ivan making notes. I told them I thought that made sense. Richard could be given some of the routine tasks as and when Jeff was comfortable passing them off to him. And I said quite honestly that the current documentation system was not as efficient or useful as we'd like it, and suggestions for improvements were welcome. Richard asked if it were likely that any engines would need an overhaul, and Jeff said there was one waiting for that on a stand at the back. Richard said, "Would it make sense for me to tackle that as a way to refresh my skills with them?" Ivan could watch and make notes of the parts and learn what are critical steps. I assume there's an overhaul manual. Sounds like a plan if Mr. Newman approves. I'll shout if I get overloaded and need help, Jeff agreed. That would probably be a good start for both you new men, I admitted. There really wasn't much sense my hanging about, so I went back to the passenger area and got myself some lunch. That is, I had soup and a sandwich from the waiting room counter. Pen. I went to the washroom and emptied it and dried the nib on some toilet paper. I bought the Calgary Herald and the Albertan so I'd have something to read, though I did have a quite new novel, Two Solitudes by Hugh McLennan, I'd bought between Christmas and New Year's. Better not lose it, as Maud said she wanted to read it. There was another novel by the same author about the time of the Halifax explosion. I liked the author's style. Probably would look for that one too. Maybe we could get it from the library. I'd been looking for something by Graham Greene, actually, but when I asked the woman serving in the bookshop where I bought the McLennan book, she said he hadn't published anything since The Ministry of Fear. It was about 1:30,
and I'd used the washroom in our office area, so before I went down to the waiting room again, I stopped by Miss Jensen's desk and said goodbye to her, and to Charles McAvoy, who was in his office and not occupied with anyone at that moment.
Part 117. Lethbridge was a similar operation to Calgary in size, though likely I thought to diminish rather than grow relative to the larger city. I introduced myself and met some of the staff, including one of the two mechanics. The other would be coming on duty late at night to check the lodestar I'd ride eastwards. I had a lot of time until my flight. It was winter outside, and getting dark by the time I'd been able to share some of my intentions regarding parts and maintenance with both the operations manager and the mechanic on duty. I returned to the waiting room and asked the desk agent where might be a place to get a meal. He recommended the Shanghai Chop House. Good Chinese food was the comment. I asked how to get there and he phoned someone and asked, "Joe, you about to go home?" Joe McLaurin was handing off to a colleague from his shift in the radio office. He dropped me at the restaurant, saying, "Ask your taxi driver to show you the high-level bridge." I wasted no time in the windy cold street and went inside. The Chinese waiter showed me to a booth and handed me a menu. He came back with a pot of tea and a small cup without handle. I looked at the menu and wasn't sure what to order, but turning to the last page I saw some combination plates and meals for one, two, and four people. I decided to have one of the meals for one with an egg roll, chop suey, fried rice and beef with vegetables. The food was tasty and there was plenty of it at what I considered a reasonable price. My only complaint was how quickly it came and I ate it. I took my time with my tea and a fortune cookie, a sort of biscuit twisted around a slip of paper with a statement, "You are building happiness out of sorrow." I put the slip of paper in my pocket. Morden Pole might get a smile from it.
Part 118. I asked the waiter if he could call me a taxi. It took a while to come. There may have been only one or two in the town. "Where to, my friend?" was the greeting my driver gave me. "I want to go to the airport, but I was told to ask to be taken to where I could see the high-level bridge." "That's easy enough. Just up the road and we're heading the right way, since the airport is easiest in the other direction, but we can work around to it pretty easily." We cannot have gone a lot more than a third of a mile when we came to a huge valley, and in the light that came of snow-covered ground, a massive viaduct was visible. "Over a mile long and over 300 feet high," my driver said. We were about to move off when I saw a light in the distance.
"Is that a train light?" I asked.
"Unless you're in a hurry, it'd be worth waiting," was the reply. Gradually the light got brighter, then a long, haunting whistle sounded and the locomotive pulling a long chain of boxcars moved towards the town across the Old Man River. Sometimes one is lucky with timing. After the caboose slid out of our view, we said nothing as we got back in the taxi and I was driven to the airport. My driver got a good tip. I got his card, which I could submit in lieu of a receipt. But I'd make a note of my driver's name and recommend him to others.
Part 119. It was around 8 when I got back to the airport. There was nobody about the hangar terminal except a radio operator and a single agent in the waiting room. When I came into the waiting room, even that person was absent to visit the toilet. My intention to take the 3 o'clock flight had been communicated to this agent. Indeed, my baggage was already behind the counter. "If you want a bit of a snooze, there's a sofa in the flight crew lounge," he said. "Crews use it when there's a delay of some sort. I'll make sure you're woken up for the flight." I took him up on his offer, but I dug out my shaving kit and got rid of my stubble first. The sofa was surprisingly comfortable, with my folded coat as a pillow.
I fell asleep sometime around 8:30 and looked at my watch what seemed a moment later to discover it was just after 2 o'clock. I used the crew washroom and then went down to the waiting room. There was just one other passenger there. The sound of aero engines was perceptible, then faint, then louder, and the Lodestar landed. Several passengers got off, and two were brought their luggage then went out to a waiting taxi. It wasn't clear they were together or sharing by necessity. The rest of the passengers were using the washroom. The airplane had one, but airborne toilets were more about necessity than convenience. I'd found myself following the same practice. My baggage and that of the other passenger were taken out to the aircraft, then at 2:50, the agent asked all passengers to board as quickly as possible to avoid letting the cabin get too cold in the winter air. We actually got away a bit early and the airplane climbed away toward Regina. Then up and down all through the day, to land in Montreal after dark at nearly 7:30 in the evening. I unscrewed myself from my seat and stiffly put on my coat to brave the cold walk to the terminal. Inside I waited for my luggage, then got a taxi home. I found everyone in the dining living room and was warmly welcomed. "Do you want anything to eat?" Maud asked. "No. We got food on the airplane, but a cup of tea would be very welcome. Then a bath and bed, though I've been sleeping on the plane." "Do you have to be at work in the morning?" Paul asked. She knew it was a Saturday. "Whether I'm expected or not, I plan to get up when I wake without an alarm." Part 120. In the morning, I woke after Maud had gone to work at Ronan's. I learnt over the next few weeks that she was doing rather well, it seemed. Hannah had suggested, and Nate took up her suggestion, that Maud should wear a tailored woman's suit. What in England we called a costume. To exemplify the shop's product. Later. It took a year or so. Women who saw Maud in one of the two suits Nate made for her asked where they could get one. The suits had jackets, but could be worn without. The skirts had pockets so Maud could have a notebook, pin box, and tailor's chalk. At this time, however, she was working in blouse and skirt, but the skirt had a pocket. Maud would handle greeting customers, getting them to try on the garments they had ordered, and doing sleeve and trouser cuff measurements and pinning. Nate would do the gentleman's measurements when a suit was ordered and call out the numbers for Maud to write them down. There were some items that were off the shelf, such as underwear and ties. They weren't central to the business, but with growing availability in the post-war economy, Maud would talk to me about possibilities, and once she had convinced herself that an idea was good, she could share it with Nate and Hannah. This morning, however, I felt like I had a hangover, though I'd had nothing to drink. I dressed and Mark gave me some coffee and toast, and I got to the office about 10:30 and put my report on Janice's desk. She was our steno. However, I'd written my report in pencil on the airplane, so I left a note on top. "Ask me if anything isn't clear, there was some turbulence, so my writing may not be perfect." I looked at some notes and correspondence on my desk, then came home. Part 121. It turned out I was getting a cold. Nevertheless, I went in on Monday, January 20th, because we were going to meet to discuss ideas to improve our systems. I made sure I had several handkerchiefs and made my way to work. I let Remy lead the meeting. He started out exactly as I would. "We have a lot of parts to order and distribute, but also to track where they go. The main problem we have is that we need to get the information back here and have it organized so we know where a part went and what happened to it. That can easily be done if we make lots of copies and have unlimited manpower, but we just have the people here, with some input from the mechanics and the flight crew if they send us the reports that they should. Right now, we essentially file things by the supplier on orders and by the date on reports.
but it would be very helpful to have files by the aircraft, so all procedures or events for a given aircraft are recorded. Even better if we also had files as well by engines, since they sometimes get swapped out, overhauled, and put back in a different aircraft. I said Ivan Badik sent a message asking whether multipart carbons or photostats might let us have copies we could file separately. Could we make either of those work? Janice responded the second or third copy is often very difficult to read, and you have to use pencil, which I think the lawyers don't like. Brian added, and photostats go all black after a couple of years. So nice try, but no prize? I asked. That's about it, Remy said. Could we use a card catalogue for aircraft and engines and add entries that reference the log sheets? I asked. That might be sensible. We started something like that a couple of years ago, but then lost the person who was running it to the RCAF. The idea was argued and criticized, but eventually I asked Brian and Janice to try to come up with a plan and costs. We'd want something like this if anything happened to an airplane. Part 122. Late Thursday afternoon, as we were about to go home, the phone rang, and I answered. Newman. Miss Rogers here. She was LaPointe's secretary. One of the Electras, CFTCQ, has crashed near Winnipeg. It was a training flight, and it seems to have been destroyed, and the two pilots on board don't seem to have survived. I thought you'd better know, as there'll no doubt be requests for information on this plane. Thanks for letting me know, Miss Rogers. Never a good situation when an aircraft goes down. I'll get started gathering information about that airplane. You have phone numbers for me and Remy all if there's anything urgent. I called everyone to gather round and we discussed what we should do. Brian offered to stay late and collate any information on the particular aircraft in our files. I told him to keep track of the overtime and that this would apply to everyone, though we may simply allow time off later. Remy and Janice left, but I stayed for half an hour to help Brian get started. Part 123. With my cold still hanging on and the crash, you can imagine I was in low spirits when I got home. A good meal of homemade baked beans improved my mood. The local nomenclature used Fevo La for the food, but Binieri for a place that made them. However, I decided to go to bed early and get up early in the morning. Indeed, I got to work before 7 and found Brian's file. One thing he had done was note previous accidents. Given the war and the number of Electras and variants in the form of Hudson bombers, I was rather used to hearing about crashes, but the number of Electras TCA had lost still was a surprise. And all the occupants were killed in all crashes. Not good. 1938 November 18th, CFTCL crashed on takeoff from Reach Ina. Two pilots killed. Cause not stated. 1941 February 6th, CFTCP crashed on approach to Armstrong where it was diverting on the way to Winnipeg with engine trouble. 12 killed. 1945 February 27th, CFTCF crashed climbing out of Moncton on a test flight when an engine quit. 2 killed. 1946 September 2nd, CFTCJ crashed on training flight approach after right engine failed. 2 killed. 1947 January 23rd, CFTCQ. The latest crash, for which we didn't know the cause. 2 killed. I saw that Brian had tried to track the engines, but our files had been evolving over the years, and we didn't have all the serial numbers to allow a full picture. But he was trying to do what I would, as the reports of engine failure had an ominous frequency. By 8:30 everyone was present, and we talked about how we should proceed. We had regular work to do, so I undertook to work with Janice to look into the aircraft that crashed yesterday and what engines were on it.
It was tedious and tiring work, but we made a bit of progress. Nothing, unfortunately, that pointed to a cause of a crash. It could, of course, be something totally unrelated to parts and maintenance, but we wanted to know as much as we could. Remy said, you know, we also lost a Lodestar at Malton when the engine failed on takeoff. That was in November 1943. I got Janice to find it and add to Brian's list. 1943 November 4th, CFTCX made forced landing in a ploughed field when an engine failed on takeoff. No fatalities, but the 9 passengers all slightly injured. When I asked how many Electra 14s TCA had purchased, Remy said 16. 5 of 16 was a pretty bad rate of loss. There had been Electra 10AS as well, but they used a different engine. But the DC-3s used the twin Wasp. We'd need to check their records, particularly if any were swapped into the Electras. Around noon, Gerard Lapointe came into our room and saw the files Janice and I had spread out on a folding table she had managed to dig up. Ah, I see you are already trying to gather information on the plane that crashed yesterday. I was going to ask you to do that. I said, Brian O'Neill stayed late last night? Until nearly 11 actually. And we have been trying to get as much information on that plane and its engines as we can. It underlines our need to keep improving our systems to track the parts and procedures, and Brian and Janice Armstrong here have been preparing a report on what we might try. Brian also has listed the 5 Electras we've lost, including TCQ, and the 1938 crash and yesterday's don't have a stated cause, but the other 3 suggest engine problems, so we're trying to see if we can track the engines on TCQ for any reported issues. There's also Lodestar TCX at Malton that suffered an engine failure in 1943. So engines are going to be high on the list of suspects. Good work in a bad situation. Thank you all. Especially for getting onto it before you were asked. We'll have to look carefully at that report as soon as it's done. Any preliminary ideas? I nodded to Brian, who said we get log sheets on maintenance and parts, but we need to be able to access those by date, aircraft, engine, and sometimes other features such as supplier, but at least the first 3. We're trying to work out how to have the logs stored, probably by date, then have some other file or card index that can be organized by the other index. The trouble is it takes time that we often don't have, and it's quite tedious and error-prone work, so we want to do what we can to make it efficient and reliable. Lapointe said we'll probably have to provide some extra resources, especially if we want to do some trials. Perhaps we can get some students during the summer if the projects are written up. Students from McGill are often looking for work starting in May. Once we've discussed the ideas in our group, I'll make sure we have some proposals that we think can be tried out, I said. Okay. Keep at it. There's going to be lots of noise for a while. Never good to have a crash, even if everyone walks away. And they didn't yesterday, unfortunately, Lapointe said, leaving the room. Part 124. February 7th, 1947. I arranged to meet Maud at Ronan's shop at just after 6 p.m. We were going to go out to dinner. There'd been a couple of inches of snow, and it was normal winter freezing temperatures, but not excessively cold. Actually warmer than in Britain now. Crazy weather they were having, and fuel and electricity shortages too, besides not being prepared like we were in Canada. We were getting used to it. Getting used to Canada, to new jobs, to a new life. Paul seemed to be doing well at school and her French was improving at home, though with some decidedly local expressions included. She had started to skate with Lise at a local rink and was able to get around on the ice, if not yet gracefully. Our destination was the Auberge St. Gabriel, which had been going for almost 200 years. It was in the old town. A bit of a walk, but Maud put her arm through mine and we trudged companionably along the sidewalks. I'd a reservation for 7. Do you think of today or our wedding day as the anniversary we should celebrate? I asked.
Both.
Maud answered enthusiastically with a laugh. We had just got to an intersection and the signal was against us, so I put my arms around her and kissed her.
Ooh.
You'll scandalize the good French-Canadian priests, Maud quipped. We have a license, though they may say it's English and not valid here.
I'll tell them I don't care. It's you I want, and you I'll stick with.
We were walking again. I said, thank you for that vote of confidence, Maud.
It's mutual, Ted.
A year ago we were both on our uppers, at least emotionally. In my case, I was also not doing too well for money either. And now we're married, in a new country, and both of us have jobs. Mine doesn't pay a lot, but I could probably survive on it.
Just.
But yours has a good salary and you seem to be doing okay with it.
Look.
I just said okay like the locals. The last few weeks have been a bit unhappy with the crash in Manitoba, I said. You weren't to blame for that, though I think it's going to make lots of work and worry for you. But you've talked about your team, and they're trying to work out improvements in the records.
We'll
make it. We walked without talking for the last couple of blocks to the restaurant. Blocks was another new expression. We enjoyed a very pleasant meal, talking about everything and nothing. As we finished our dessert, I said, it's been a very special year in my life. I would never have thought I could be here in a very old building, eating such a good meal with such a wonderful woman who is my partner and best supporter.
Thank you, Maud.
I want to thank you too, Ted. But I think we have to thank us. The team we've become, and that includes Pole. If she hadn't come into our lives, we could very likely have bumbled along as landlady and lodger, both in our own little pits of unhappiness. We would have stayed leftovers.
Yes.
I think you are right. I don't feel that way anymore, despite the turmoil of the last few weeks at work. No more leftovers, unless we get to take home some of the food from this place.